So both of our projects started in about a little over four years ago. And so we've been sort of running in parallel and trying to cross-pollinate in these two projects all along. As we, you know, we were both working with the same species of livestock, although dairy and beef have considerable differences in the way you really manage those systems and the issues you face. So we decided that it would be very fruitful to have a joint symposium to really have a discussion of some of the benefits of some of the findings of our particular projects, but also I think maybe to get some insights into what are the issues behind animal agriculture that are facing animal agriculture globally, and maybe what are some of the challenges and successes and benefits of these very large integrated projects. So with that, we're going to start with a keynote from Michael Lee. He's joining us here from Rothamsted, and he's going to open with steps to sustainable ruminant livestock production. And as he's coming up, if anyone needs CEUs, we do have a CEU sheet here to sign.
Okay, thank you, Jean. Well, thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you, Chuck. I was lucky enough to go on the grazing lands tour yesterday, and one of the things that really, really hit me was not just about the grazing lands, but the great diversity within the lands here in Florida, the fantastic fauna and flora that you have in this part of the world. You know, the alligators, the raccoons, the largest jumping spider I've ever seen in my life. And I suppose really when we think about how we're going to utilize land to feed people, we've got to think of how we do this while also maintaining this fantastic diverse landscape that you have. And that is really, really challenging. So big thank you for the invitation. Big thank you to Chuck. You'll notice that a logo at the bottom, the Global Farm Platform Initiative. So this is a grouping which I'll talk a little bit about at the moment. But the grazing cap, Molly John at Wisconsin, and the beef cap, and Chuck Rice has been very supportive of the Global Farm Platform Initiative. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. So I'm sure you're all aware, you know, if we're talking about sustainability, the place to start is the grand challenges around food security. And we're sure, I'm preaching to the converted, we all understand the challenges are going to be on population growth. You know, lots of predictions, but, you know, the view is now we're going to have approximately 9 billion people by 2050, so how are we going to feed those people equitably as we want to move towards equitable provision of food globally. Second one, increased urbanisation. Now this is the one that really, really worries me the most if I think about the major challenges that we have for feeding a population. Because this hits us in two ways. First of all, we have more people leaving rural communities and living in cities. And as they do that, they change their eating patterns. We have what Sir John Beddington, the former UK Chief Scientific Officer, said. We have this nutrition transition, and it changes the way people eat, and they want to consume more Western-style diet, richer in animal proteins and sugar-laden beverages. So that's one particular area. But another area in urbanisation that really, really concerns me is that as people move from the cities, they move from rural communities. Now, if we're going to address the issues of feeding 9 billion people in 2050, we need intelligent, young farmers. We need people to take on those issues, be innovators, be driving for the solutions. Therefore, we need to have that group, that rural community, growing and improving. And I believe that we have a brain drain away from agriculture, which is really concerning. So that increasing urbanisation hits us in two ways. Losing people, losing farmers from that urban areas, and also this nutrition transition as we move into cities. And of course, we don't even have a status quo. We have climate change. So the solutions that we know now, the agriculture we have, the crops that we have, the livestock we have, is not what we're going to need in 2050. So we've got to think about new agriculture, new interactions, new solutions mixing between crop and livestock systems and developing agriculture for 2050, but we need to do it now. And that might be a realisation that we haven't got the correct livestock and we haven't got the correct crops to address sustainable food production in a very different climate. And of course, I've already mentioned, we've got this demand for animal protein. So, if we think about this nutrition transition and feeding a population equitably, this is the planet Earth, I'm sure we're all recognising it. And if we were to feed the current population equitably on a Western-style diet, based on resources and land use and current agriculture, we would need approximately 1.5 extra planets to feed the current population equitably now. If we fast forward to 2050, based on resources, utilisation and population growth, we would need 5.5 extra planets to feed the population equitably based on a Western style diet. So we've got two questions. Either we know where we can find 5.5 extra planets and therefore we can just carry on as usual, or the realisation that we probably can't find the extra planets and we really need to think about the way that we farm now if we are going to feed that population in 2050. And of course, as I've mentioned, we all have this increasing demand for meat. So this is some data which we took from the FAO looking at changing meat consumption from 1961 to 2011. We did a colour code, so the redder the country, the greater change in animal protein. And in this particular graph, it's meat. I've got one also for dairy. And you can see in terms of Asia and particularly China, the huge changes in demand for animal-based protein. So therefore, we've got to think about the solutions globally. Food production is a global commodity. We need to think of how we work with our partners globally. And that's some of the things that we've been addressing within the Global Farm Platform Initiative. And of course, what are the role of ruminants? If we think about this demand for animal protein, you know, there's a huge increase in poultry consumption. In fact, in the UK, red meat consumption has been declining for the last 25 years. But poultry consumption in that same period has gone up by 326%. So what are the correct types of livestock to deliver sustainability? And this has been a major debate for many years, and the role of ruminants has been demonised based on their inefficiency and particularly their carbon tax when they are producing. So if we think about this, so this is some data which a good friend and colleague, Mike Wilkinson, pulled together for the British Society of Animal Science back in 2011. And here he outlined why ruminants were getting such a bad deal if we were thinking about food security, and possibly we should move our livestock patterns towards monogastric production, be it pigs or poultry. So in these figures here, I've given the total energy required to produce 1 megajoule of edible energy. So for example, upland lamb is a typical UK system for utilising ruminants, where lambs are grazed on the uplands of Wales and Scotland. It looks beautiful, but it takes 62.5 megajoules of energy to produce 1 usable megajoule of energy for human nutrition. Lowland suckler beef, 37. Cereal beef, 13.2, which is probably most akin with feedlot systems, because we don't have feedlot systems in the UK. And then pigs and poultry meat come in at 9.3 and 4.5. So they're much more energy efficient. And you can do the same analysis for protein. They're so much more protein efficient. But of course, this isn't a fair comparison, because the type of feeds going into these systems are very, very different. And one fairer comparison is to have a look at the amount of edible protein in, human edible protein in, and human edible protein out, and likewise human edible energy in, and human edible energy out. And when you do this comparison, you can actually see that the role of ruminants actually comes to the fore and positioning with monogastrics. The potential of ruminants to utilize resources which are not suitable for human consumption, to utilize land that is not suitable for the production of crops. So therefore, the balance of evidence on this argument will basically say we should include ruminants as part of a sustainable solution for food security. But of course, there are major challenges. And of course, 26% of the Earth's high-speed landmass is pasture, as Steinfeld mentioned in 2006. So we cannot forget about the role of ruminants, but there are issues to tackle. So back in, I think, 2013 it was, we had a symposium in Bristol in the UK, where we got together a whole group, this was originally funded by the World Universities Network, where we start to think, okay, what are the things we need to tackle if we are going to move towards a more sustainable ruminant production system globally? And we summarised the data and we got it published in Nature in 2014. And these were the six areas which we concentrated on. I spent a little time on four of those at the moment. Competition with human edible feed, I've already mentioned. So that is a major role for ruminants. And if we're going to think about sustainable ruminant production, we need to minimise cereals, pulses going into ruminant systems and optimise the use of byproducts and fibre. That is a clear passage for sustainable ruminant production. And then I'm going to touch on the next four. I'm not going to talk about the last one, husbandry and management, because that is a specific... I could go on for another hour on that, which I won't. So, just a few of these just to show about the area of research that the Global Farm Platform is concentrating on. The first issue is poor animal health and welfare. And this is specifically working with our partners in Asia and Africa to tackle poor animal health. So first and foremost, we lose if we have animals are lost before they're productive. So of course, disease really affects genetic gain. Because if we haven't got health, we cannot advance genetics. If our starting point, if our livestock isn't inherently healthy, we cannot advance genetics and we can't advance nutrition. So we need our starting point if we're developing new systems to be inherently healthy. And of course there are other issues associated with zoonotic disease, particularly in Africa. And the areas that we're working on here are obviously hygiene, quarantine, preventative medicine, surveillance, reducing stocking densities, and specifically looking at the genetics of the animal from a health perspective. And of course, I've mentioned welfare, but I haven't put any points associated with that. Because welfare is an inherent part of sustainable livestock production. I always say to my colleagues at Rothamsted, you know, if you're looking at intensification in arable production, it's easy. You just grow more wheat in the same area of land. If you're looking at sustainable production of livestock, it's a lot more complex. Because these are sentient animals, sentient beings. And we've got to include welfare as a metric of sustainability. The third one, environmental footprint. Of course, I've mentioned the fact that ruminants are demonised because of their low efficiency for nitrogen use and also their emissions of greenhouse gases. But we've got to then understand why ruminants evolved to be inefficient for nitrogen. Ruminants evolved to be inefficient for nitrogen because they graze. They take a proportion of nitrogen from their diet and return a large proportion of nitrogen back to the soil in manure. So therefore that will fertilise that, improve the fertility of soils and allow a flush growth of grass to grow as the animals move on. So therefore we need to think about why they are inefficient in their particular context, but also address greenhouse gas. There's numerous mitigation methodologies and improvements, for example, animal breeding and balanced nutrition, where we can reduce greenhouse gas. But I think we have to hold our hands up in the ruminant industry and say, yes, we're never going to completely tackle greenhouse gas. We're never going to have a system which is completely balanced for carbon for ruminants. We're just not. Sorry, Alan Savory, we are not. So therefore, we've got to say and position life cycle assessment around ruminants about the other aspects that ruminants bring other than just greenhouse gas. I think we have to say, yes, if we're looking at a system, yes, ruminants are never going to win when we look at carbon compared to monogastrics. But ruminants bring so much other things. For example, we need to look at ruminant production for everything they produce: hides, wool, traction, biogas, the role of ruminants and livestock in the developing world. We need to look at biodiversity and ecosystem services and how ruminants interconnect with that. We need to look at carbon capture and understand the differences between manure and synthetic fertilisers when we're comparing systems. A lot of the papers which completely demonise ruminant production don't look at an alternative scenario and the potential use of synthetic fertilisers. We need to compare greenhouse gas from mechanised arable agriculture and food processing. So when we're comparing land use, we do it on a fair footing. And we look at all the components as part of an LCA. And of course, realising that yes, we do want to tackle greenhouse gas, and we look for nutritional strategies to mitigate, but we won't base reports just on a single metric. So I don't know how many people are aware of this recent report that came out of the University of Oxford, Grazed and Confused. It concentrated on one single metric, again, carbon. And if you just concentrate on one metric, you will get a skewed answer. And that skewed answer will be take ruminants off pasture and put them in houses and feed them starch. Well, that's skewed. That is not a sustainable solution for ruminant production. But if you look at sustainability from a single metric, you will get a single metric response. We need to think about ruminant production more holistically than that. So the next area which we spend a lot of time working on is species and genotypes not suited to the environment. So again, when we're looking at solutions for improving production across the world, the first view for many government agencies, politicians, NGOs, is to have a look at countries which are extremely efficient. For example, like the US with the Holstein dairy cow, and we can take that cow and drop it in parts of the world and expect it to deliver the levels of yield which it does in the US. And that is just incredibly naive, damaging and destructive. Not only is it poor animal welfare, but often those farmers will have to change the way they farm, significantly increase the amounts of inputs, and not get the reward that they were expecting, because the levels of yield when these animals are stressed is not to the level that they would be expecting. These animals are not suited to the environment. If you move these animals into parts of the world, you have to change the environment to suit them. So therefore, you have to put them in houses. You have to cool these animals. You have to massively change the food systems. You have to massively change the veterinary structure. And of course, there are more sustainable ways of delivering improved livestock in these parts of the world. And that's to have a look at the indigenous genetics which is there. Concentrating on breeding programs, concentrating on nutritional programs, which will improve their levels of yield. And that's not to say that we can't have a look at improving genetics through introducing specific species, but they must be done at a terminal cross level. And we need to keep the basics of the fantastic genetics that are in these indigenous livestock. Because these livestock have the key, they have the genes for heat tolerance and disease resistance. The photos that I've shown here, so the top one is some Holstein cows being milked here in Asia. This is in Laos. And then the bottom one is some animals. So this is a crossbred animal which takes huge amounts of resources. This is a farm that we work with in Kerala, in India. And this is the mature cow, the world's smallest cow. It's not much bigger than a goat, but it's perfectly adapted to these farming systems where they have very, very few, very, very low inputs. These animals are let out and they all provide 2 to 3 pints of milk per day. Perfect for the farmer. perfect for that subsistence household. The next area we need to look at is the type of food we produce, the healthiness of that food and reduction in waste. And also realise that we consume too much. We need to start thinking about the level of animal-based protein that we consume in the West. So a starting point to say is, okay, well, what is an optimal amount of food that we should consume? Now, some research carried out by Professor Ian Givens at the University of Reading has looked at optimal nutrition provision based on key nutrients which we can get from animal-based protein, like essential amino acids, like heme iron, like omega-3, and suggested about 70 grams per day is optimum for human health in terms of the maximum provision of nutrients from animal-based protein. Now, we consume way over 70 grams a day, so I think we need to start thinking about the level that we consume. So therefore, if we're saying reduce the amount we consume, we should concentrate on improving the quality of the product we actually produce. So we need to do, and there's lots of research looking at the lipid content of animal-based products, particularly driving the omega-3 level. So actually, when you're consuming animal products, you're improving your omega-3 to omega-6 ratio instead of putting it to the detriment. Looking at protein, amino acid supply, micronutrients, particularly minerals and vitamins, and looking at developing improved feeding systems and livestock production systems which optimise their flow. And of course, reducing waste. A big part of sustainability and food security is reducing waste. And understanding where food is wasted in different parts of the world. So in the developing world, low to middle income countries, food is lost in the soil or where animals are being produced through disease and ill health or poor agronomy. That's a big part of this conference, improving soil health and improving agronomy. But in the West, food is wasted in the refrigerator or the restaurant. When it's past its use-by date, or its sell-by date, or I've just bought too much, or it's just too cheap, so I've bought gallons of milk, which I can throw away because I want to buy some more anymore. So we need to think about how we actually consume and waste. And I've just put some examples from the UK. 1.3 billion tonnes of wasted food each year. That's globally. In the UK, it's 1.3 million tonnes. The third biggest food lost or wasted in the UK is milk, because it's cheaper than bottled water. Milk is cheaper than bottled water. What is wrong when we've got to a situation where a product is cheaper than water? So, in summary, in addressing these issues, we need to think about what our future farming industries are going to look like. And I think positioning around the three needs of sustainability. So when we're thinking about future agriculture, we need to ensure that we deliver these three needs. And at the heart of this is soil health. Health in the soil. Everything starts from the soil. So if we think about what I mean by these three needs, well, first of all, economic need. Farms are businesses. So therefore, they need to drive a profit. And they need to drive a profit not only which keeps the farmer in business and off the streets, but a level of profit which encourages young people to say, I want to be in this industry. This industry is going somewhere. They're using innovation, they're using technology. Agriculture is where I want my career to be. That is where we start thinking about a deliverable of economic need. Societal need. Society needs states in food production that food industry provides a product which, first of all, society wants, and secondly, is not inherently damaging to society. So as a livestock industry, we need to provide high quality nutrition, but not at a level that people will overeat and overconsume. So therefore, we've got to deliver that societal need, high quality products which are consumed responsibly. And then finally, environmental need. While providing that profit to the farmer and providing that high-value product, which is not damaging to society, we also cannot damage the planet which will affect future generations' ability to grow that food. If we deliver these three needs, and that's what our research in the Global Farm Platform is driving, then we'll move towards a more sustainable future. And the way to do this is complex. A good example of beef. So when you're thinking about the most sustainable way of producing beef, there's lots of metrics which you need to consider based on those three needs of sustainability. And I've given a few of them here, like animal performance, carrying capacity, nutritional quality, and also nutrition provision per area of land. What nutrients are given from that land if it's grazed by beef, as opposed to what nutrients would be driven from that land if we grew wheat there or we grew turnips associated. So it's actually having a look at optimum land use based on not kilograms of meat or kilograms of product, but nutrients, calories, essential amino acids, vitamin B12, omega-3. What is the most sustainable way of driving nutrients from land? And of course, it's really complex when we start to look at ruminant production systems, because there's many different ways of producing ruminants. Nomadic systems in Africa, intensive productions, grass-fed, cut and carry. And each of these systems, there will be different trade-offs and different metrics which we need to collect. So if we're serious about developing a pathway for sustainable ruminant production, we have to consider all these production systems. And we need to think about this globally. So 3 years ago now, we started to form the Global Farm Platform Initiative, which was like-minded people from around the world who wanted to move ruminant production on a more sustainable path. And we've now developed our consortium, developed our group, and we're starting now to really develop research around this community of people. So we have farms in many parts of the world with different types of ruminant production systems. So we have more rangeland cow-calf operations in Canada, University of Alberta. Of course, we have Kansas State University and the beef cap. We have Wisconsin in terms of the WIXT program and the dairy cap. We also have links with Penn State, with Robert Van Soon looking at feedlots and intensive dairies. We have SEAT in Colombia looking at the potential of Breccia. We have Uruguay looking at mixed livestock systems. We have SRUC in Scotland looking at the uplands. We have Northwick in the UK looking at the lowlands. We have numerous partners. The last year I've spent many months in Africa developing these relationships, particularly with pastoralists, cut and carry systems, but also moving from subsistence to more intensive productions in Africa. And we have partners, ILRI, based in Nairobi in Tanzania and Ethiopia, and SSLLP, which is an NGO in Malawi. We have tropical agriculture in Kerala. We have numerous partners, I'm delighted to say now, in China, to CAU, CAS, and CAS, as well as Zhejiang University, looking at the sustainability of Chinese dairy industry and also the potential of grazing Mongolia and the steppes. We have partners in Australia, Farm 20, Future Farm 2050 in Perth, which is actually now looking and saying, okay, let's have a look at the type of agriculture we need in 2050 and do it now. So they're using their farm for solutions for 2050. So it's a great part of the network. We have Sydney and the University of Melbourne has recently joined us, and Massey University in New Zealand, specifically looking at grazing livestock. So I just wanted a few minutes because I'm, Jean, am I?
You're
10 minutes. 10 minutes, oh, I've got plenty of time. Okay, so I've gone too fast. So I just want to talk about some of the research which we're doing at Northwick, which I'm sure you're aware is a part of Rothamsted Research. So this is a member of the Global Farm Platform family, and specifically here we're looking at temperate grazing livestock systems. So the farm platform is particularly special because we've taken a portion of the land that we have at Northwick and split it into three small farms, which we call farms. They're about 22 hectares in size. And those three farmlets, we said, okay, we're going to manage these under different strategies. Because the research we want to do is not at the animal scale, or the field, or the plot scale, it's going to be at the farm system scale. So we've basically made three experimental farms as part of our larger farm at Northwick. So the three systems we chose are, first and foremost, two most common grazing systems in the UK. So those people who know about UK agriculture, the first one is permanent pasture. So it's pasture that probably hasn't been reseeded for 15 or 20 years. And the farmer use N, P and K inputs to dry map the yield. The blue system is our quasi-organic system. So we don't want it under organic principles because we think they're too tight, but we're taking what's great about that organics is to use clovers, and this is white clover, to fix atmospheric nitrogen. So in that system we use clover, we want to retain a cover of around 30% in that sward, and we do not use inorganic air. So we just balance for P and K in the blue system. And then our red system is based on a 5-year reseed. So we basically say, we speak to the grass breeders and say, okay, what's your best germplasm currently? And we use that then for a 5-year period. So the red treatment currently is based on the leading high sugar ryegrass out of the UK. And Jenny's been doing some work on fasciolaniums, deep rooting grasses, which also are part of that red treatment. So there are three systems. You can think, okay, well, what's special about that? Anybody could do that. Wow. This is where the exciting bit comes. Each one of our farmers has 5 catchments. And each of those catchments or fields is hydrologically isolated. The soil type at Northwick Farm Platform basically hits a pan of clay, so when water percolates down, it can move then horizontally. And at each of these little spots, you probably can't see it very well, is the lowest point on the catchment. Through a series of French drains at the edges and bunding, we can collect 97% of the water which percolates through these fields. At these points, we have one of these flume laboratories, which measures water chemistry every 15 minutes. So we can look at nutrient losses, particularly in terms of nitrogen, carbon and phosphorus, associated with those fields. The premise and what we're driving at in terms of sustainable agriculture and temperate lands is that we want nutrients to walk off the farm in beef and sheep and not trickle off the farm in water or go off the farm into the air. So we can capture nutrients lost in water. We can also capture nutrient losses associated with the air. Because each one of these large fields has an eddy covariance tower, which captures carbon dioxide, methane and nitrous oxide emissions. We also have LIFOR chambers, which are distributed through the farm platform, looking at gas fluxes associated with the plant and the soil. We also use boreal laser techniques to fire over the top of our grazing animals so we can have a more accurate assessment of methane. And we also, when these animals are housed, I've got 5 minutes, I'm using my time well, we also, when we house our animals, we use green feed so we can measure methane. So therefore we've got a complete, really high level of understanding the nutrient flows at a farm level. And of course, I should say, each one of these systems uses beef and sheep, so 30 weaned cattle, 75 using their lambs. When the cattle are housed, the FYM from those animals is only returned to those farmlets, and silage that is produced from those farmlets is only fed to those animals. So the type of data which we're collecting, and this is, I'll start showing now some of this data, this is associated with the baseline year. Because one of the issues, obviously, with this type of experiment is that you have one farmer, so you're thinking about replication. So what we did for the first 2 years is collect really detailed baseline data from each of those farmlets when they were all permanent pasture. So we could then use that as a covariance going forward when we applied our management regime. So this is some data associated with the baseline which we've just had accepted in the journal Animal. So then you can start to see how the farm behaves in different fields. The first thing is you'll notice the heterogeneity of a lot of these data sets. So you can see then a colour code associated with soil organic carbon, soil organic carbon heterogeneity, botanical diversity on our farm, water discharge, nitrogen discharge, sediment discharge associated with those flumes from those fields. And then, of course, in terms of what I'm particularly interested in, which is the livestock, because I'm a livestock scientist, sorry, Jenny, we can then start looking at production levels, so cumulative weight of cattle, cumulative weight of sheep, cumulative weight of livestock associated with those other metrics. We then can have a look at production of those fields, silage production, live weight gain, all those other metrics which I indicated we will start to add in. And then we can start to produce sort of these correlations. And so, as I said, you know, this is based on 3 years' data when everything is permanent pasture. And we can find some really interesting things. First of all, the correlation between soil organic carbon and live weight gain was huge. Understanding, we know that, as I started, sustainability associated in the soil. And here's some data from the farm platform to show that. Good levels of soil organic carbon will drive live weight performance. And also, good soil organic carbon will reduce water discharge. You need cleverer people than me, like Jenny, to understand why that might be, but greater, I suppose, greater porosity of the soil structure, better carbon and nutrients will hold that water for longer. And some of the work which Jenny's been doing with the fasciolaniums hopefully will add to that. Then, of course, the heterogeneity of that soil organic carbon is negatively associated with live weight gain, which is what we'd expect. If soil organic carbon is associated with it, then of course the more variable that is, the opposite is true. So that further emphasises the importance of soil organic carbon and live weight performance. And then stocking rate and density. Again, another correlation between soil organic carbon and the amount of animals that land will support. And also we've got a link here between stocking rate and botanical composition. We need to look more into that based on the type of swards that we've put forward. I think a lot of them are quite open swards. And again, there's another great link in terms of botanical diversity and soil organic carbon, which again we might expect because of those different rooting structures from different plants. So some initial causal relationships which we're developing using this fantastic research that we've got at Northwick. You know, soil organic carbon relating to pasture productivity, relating to animal productivity. So this is just a little snapshot of some of the work that we're doing at Northwick and wanting to tie up with our global farm platforms. So Jenny's been leading a project funded by the GCRF, which is looking at partners across that global farm platform and measuring soil health indicators. So we can actually learn from this really complex data set which we have at Northwick with our partners in other parts of the world. So, Gene, I'm going to summarise. So of livestock, of course, are more than just food. And this is really important when we hear a lot about this debate about the role of livestock in food security and the damaging of methane. We always have to remember the importance of livestock and not just as food production. They're aesthetically pleasing. They're beautiful. Look at that picture in Scotland of animals grazing the uplands there. I'm not biased. they're vital in parts of the world where we haven't yet got mechanisation for draft power. Of course, as well, we're starting to understand this more, some of the work we're doing at Northwick, the importance of fibre. I think we are moving towards a revaluing the wool industry. There's many parts of the world that still really does value the wool industry, but we've been doing some work now looking at the value of UK wool and possibly reducing our reliance on fossil fuels and petroleum chemicals. And of course, livestock are in many, many, many different products. I always have really good, enjoyable discussions with vegans and try to find out actually where they are using animal products, which usually shocks them. But anyway, there's always a link and there's always a way that they are using livestock products. And of course, they're great fertilizers and fuels. So not only returning nutrients to the soil, so I put this one in for Jenny particularly, not only returning nutrients to the soil in terms of cow pats, but also in parts of the world actually they dry these pats and burn them as part of energy. And then of course, these fantastic picture of goats, which I recently took when I was in Africa, where they refer to these animals as their bio ATMs. They haven't got a bank. Their wealth is actually in those animals, a vital part of the resource and their livelihoods. So in summary, Jean, thank you very much. Livestock are part of the solution for sustainable global food security, but they do not come without risk. And there's still lots to do. Thank you.